And they're not dischargeable debts. Mm-hmm. If an individual goes into bankruptcy, he doesn't get rid of tax liabilities.
Well, you've seen a lot of changes. What was the attitude when you first started in 1922? Was not depression. And what was the attitude to bankruptcy then? Wasn't it a disgrace?
It was talked about the same as, for example, my father was a merchant in Connersville. He never had a fire or a failure. And that was one of the things, Sam Goodman, uh-huh. He never had a fire or a failure. Uh-huh. Right? That was a boost, if you know what I mean. He went broke several times. He had a couple of fires, and he had so-and-so justified loss and made some money and all that sort of thing. It was looked down. It was a stigma. It was a stigma on a man's record. But over the years, as people became more, lukewarm about these things, it just didn't add up.
And during the Depression, there were so many of them.
And all that sort of thing. It sort of lost its that feeling that he went broke and came out of it rich, because most of them had to start from scratch again. Mm-hmm. And if they were able to get a new line of credit, fine. They just had to earn their way. And I get that story all the time. People come in to me after having through bankruptcy. How long must I wait before I can buy an automobile or buy a home and get a mortgage?
Because
I tell them there's nothing in the law. It's up to you to sell yourself to the person from whom you're trying to borrow money, or the bank.
Mm-hmm.
Right now is a very rough time, because under the new bankruptcy law, which went into effect in October 79, Pennsylvania had what we call an exemption law. If a man went bankrupt, or even if it was a sheriff's sale, he could claim a $300 exemption. That was the limit. Now, under this new bankruptcy act, he can go into bankruptcy, or he and his wife can both go into bankruptcy. But basically, they have a wife and husband sign everything. And each of them can claim $7,500 out of the real estate if they own their home. For example, a home is worth $35,000, we'll say. Maybe it's a $15,000 mortgage. They go bankrupt. Each of them can claim $7,500, assuming title's in both names, which basically it always is. So that takes up $15,000. They own a $15,000 mortgage, $30,000, so that the trustee in bankruptcy, the man who's supposed to liquidate the assets, he's left trying to find a buyer for $35,000. How much? What's he going to net?
Mm-hmm.
And that's now there's $1,200 exemption out of automobiles. There's $400 here. There's $200 there. It's so different. Now that's going to be in effect until the state of Pennsylvania passes a new exemption law. Until then, the federal law prevails.
Well, how do you feel about that?
I think it's wrong, because now, I don't see how any bank or finance company can make a loan to an individual, or his wife, or both of them, or individually, unless they get a guarantor on the side, maybe the parents of the couple or what have you, who may own their home and maybe it's free and clear and they're living on it. But without a guarantor, I don't see how they can make a loan because of these exemptions.
I'm not sure I understand.
I can put it this way. A man goes to a bank, mm-hmm. and he wants to borrow $10,000. He wants it in business or whatever the reason may be.
He's already gone bankrupt.
He's gone bankrupt. And they say, we can't make a loan to you because you can claim your exemptions and wipe us out. If we don't have some security and the security we would normally would have, we won't have it again. So
what was behind such a thing?
I would say basically this new bankruptcy law is a result of abuses countrywide. For example, in Texas, you can live in an apartment, have an apartment, we'll say, in this building, own this building, have an apartment here. This was your home. You could go bankrupt and claim this home, what they call the homestead exemption. You could claim the whole building as your exemption.
Mm-hmm. The whole building.
The whole building. It's against $300 in Pennsylvania. You claim the whole exemption in Texas. The whole home. Mm-hmm. The whole building. You lived in it. That was the disparity between the various states on their exemption laws.
Mm-hmm.
Because the older, the newer the state, say Texas or whatever it might be, or New Mexico or Arizona, recently, 1912 or 19, these different states, like Arizona, they were more liberal in their attitudes. Is against going back to the 1700 when Pennsylvania was founded.
So some people would deliberately incorporate in those states.
That's right. That's right. Or as an individual, he could claim these exemptions. And this new law, I'm against it. I don't like it because I think it's unfair, number one. Number two, I think the new law was written by mostly college professors on bankruptcy law who never had any practical experience and don't realize just what is happening, what can happen. When I tell you that last year in the Western District of Pennsylvania, between the district office in Pittsburgh and the one in Erie, that's the two places they have in Western District, there must have been close to 3,000 bankruptcy cases. Well, that's four or five times as many any other year. And this year, the way it started out...
And it's because of these exemptions, you think?
Oh, well, that's why people are taking advantage of it. Mm-hmm. Taking advantage of it.
Hmm. Are you working for a change in this?
Oh, I'm not lifting a finger at my age. Just the younger people have to do anything. If they want it that way, I mean, what do they care? The lawyer, if he's handling your receivership, he doesn't care because if he goes to sell a property, he can sell it free and clear of all the liens against it and take out these fees.
There's some people who have some social responsibility.
Oh, yes, but...
And what happens to our economy with all this?
It's a killer. It can't be good. It can't be good because people get into this habit of saying, well, I can go bankrupt. Under the old law, you're entitled to go bankrupt once in 6 years. Mm-hmm. And if you were just doing it, and if you didn't get your discharge because of your conduct, fraud or whatever it might be, those debts were never discharged. You couldn't get a discharge. Mm-hmm. So therefore, you were hanging high in the air. But they're so much more liberal today in these things. And the whole system, they have what they call now, under this new act, it's all federal, you understand. They have what they call pilot operations. I think in five states, Pennsylvania is not one of them, where they're testing out all these things, and they'll make a report in a couple of years, on basis of which they'll go in with amendments to the act, what they think is some of the things they ought to throw out and other things they should put in. Mm-hmm. But until this thing is straightened out in some fashion, it's just too bad. And the bankruptcy judges today, really, they're not functioning as such because they're more like appellate judges. They're only hearing complaints after the trustee has done something they don't like. Before that, they handle the cases themselves. Now, we only have two bankruptcy judges in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. One is Jerry Gibson, and next to the new one is Joe Cassetti. Mm-hmm. Cassetti was city treasurer in Pittsburgh. Both of them are very decent, high-class fellows. But the federal district judges, I'm talking about men like Baron McCune from Washington, PA, Hube Teitelbaum, Ziegler, these fellows, they're all good men, but they don't get near bankruptcy anymore in the federal district mm-hmm. court. It's all in these, what these, they create these new bankruptcy judges. And they're more or less sitting around just waiting. They're still sitting on old cases, stuff that's still dragging. For example, I have a couple of cases go back to 4 or 5 years.
Where there's been no settlement? No,
just final disposition. Why? Because you had to bring a suit against someone for obtaining a payment or obtaining some property through some fraud, and you bring a suit, and the courts are so busy and so crowded for 3 or 4 years before the case comes up for trial.
Well, now, the business is not dissolved, though.
Oh, it's been liquidated. But I'm talking about you may have
the
suits.
Creditors, yes.
For example, if you are, say, a relative or a close friend of the bankrupt, and you're owed some money, you're paid off a few weeks or a few months before he goes bankrupt. Now, that's what they call a preference. You preferred him over the other creditors. And that's an illegal thing. It's a civil action, nothing criminal about it. Mm-hmm. And the trustee finds out about it, he'll try to go after this man to get that money back. He shouldn't get any greater percentage of his claim than anyone else. And these things drag out, so there's still some of that hangovers from, but go back before the new act went into effect in October 79. So there's still some of that. But
now, let me back up here. The October 79 is the national act.
It was all national.
Pennsylvania will eventually have their own.
Their own exemption. They'll have the act provides that the federal exemption part of the statute mm-hmm. will remain in effect, be effective, in other words, until unless the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania legislature passes a new exemption law. Then it'll supersede the federal act mm-hmm. as part of it. Well, the politicians in Harrisburg haven't gotten around to it yet to found it.
Don't you think the Reagan administration will change this? Economic policy.
Well, yeah, that is true, but the time to get around to it is going to be a couple of years. They have more immediate problem, if you know what I mean, to try to get the economy straightened out. But in Harrisburg, because here is the legislature, the Democrats control the House, and the Republicans control the Senate, and whether it's a judge being up for appointment or what have you, it's a part of the game. We sit around the lunch table every day at the colonnade, and there's four or five judges sit there. And even, for example, today, among other judges sitting here was Judge Walker from Meadville, who's trying the Wick case.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a high-class judge. We don't talk anything about the case while he's at the table, but there's Jim McGregor, the judge, and Judge Louis, who I think is the best one we have, even though he's a senior judge, and Frederick Weir, and Judge Jim McKenna. These fellows are the senior men past 70, and they kick this stuff around all day long. Mm-hmm. Arnie Wilner will sit there, and Phil Baskin will come in a couple times a week, and Mike Berger comes in.
And they all get in the car. Have your own little round table of law there.
Well, actually, the table's for four. Uh-huh. Sometimes there's 12 at the table. You say, how can you get 12 people? Well, they back in, they back out. Uh-huh. Marion Finkelhor will sit there.
You learn from each other.
Oh, yeah, they kick everything around and what's happening. And here the judges get blamed for these sentences and all that sort of thing, and they're not at fault. McGregor said to us last week, and by the way, he's a very smart cookie, and very likable, great golfer. He sits, it's in the low 70s. He said, I got a call from the jail. They want to release certain prisoners because they have no more room. They're sleeping on cots in the gymnasium in the jail.
Mm-hmm.
He said, we don't parole anyone. There's a parole board. We're blamed for light sentences. We're giving the sentences. But they get out because they just haven't got room for them.
No.
He says, and the people, if you have an election to for a bond issue to put up another jail, the people vote it down.
That's right.
But they talk about it.
What about in all your experiences, you must have had, what was your first bankruptcy case? Do you remember that?
Yeah, I mean, you must bear in mind when I started out, I said, with a senior man who was some 20-year-old, he would interview the client,
mm-hmm.
and wouldn't be maybe the second or third time that he had an interview with him, they would call me in.
Mm-hmm.
And because the man was embarrassed, he was in financial difficulty, and he maybe did a few little things.
Like a side door or something?
But he was just embarrassed about the fact that he was in hot water financially, and maybe did a few little things that weren't exactly 100% kosher.
Mm-hmm.
The result is that he would maybe talk to Mr. Alpert, who wouldn't, if somebody else was in the room, he wouldn't want to talk.
Yeah, right.
So I had to win their confidence, and they get the feeling I was all right to be in the room with them.
Mm-hmm.
And then that time on, Mr. Alpert would say to me, well, you prepare the papers and put down everything you can think of, everything you know. And this man was so meticulous and so that his pleadings that we prepared were later on down to federal court. If you came down here looking for something, you're Joe Blow, and you came down looking for something, the clerk would say, well, I'll pull out one of Mr. Alpern's cases and you can follow his papers. First he would say, write it out in longhand. And I'd write out sheet after sheet after sheet, and then they'd sit down with him, and he would start with a pencil, just like that one. Then he'd start writing around the whole way around the paper and so on and so forth. And then have the girl type what he called a rough draft. Sometimes three and four rough drafts drive the girls crazy. But when we were finished,
he had
a case prepared, and I had learned to prepare pleadings, which was very, you know, effective.
Mm-hmm.
And then he sent me out to Greensburg to try a case. It was a case I should have lost, and I won.
Why did you win it?
Well, because the lawyer on the other side, a Jewish lawyer, by the way, was stupid enough. When I finished my case and I wasn't able to prove the case, it was an awkward situation. All he had to do was make a motion to have the case dismissed, and the court would have granted it. The Common Police Court in Greensburg is an equity case, and instead of that, he puts in his defense. And then on cross examination of the bankrupt, on the stand, I brought out all these things I couldn't bring out when in my side of the case. Mm-hmm. And the judge ruled in my favor. Then I came back, Mr. Allen said, I don't know how you did it. How you did it? He was so elated. Not that there was much involved.
It was his training then.
Oh, sure. He was a taskmaster. I'm telling you, many a time, I almost literally bit a hole in my tongue to keep from lashing out at him.
You get so angry.
Oh, I mean, it's so tough. You know, we had with us Solus Horvitz in later years.
Was he unfair?
No, but he was, as I say, was so nervous, high-strung and all that sort of thing. Just had to be right and right and right. Yeah, I mean, never forget, we had Solus Horvitz with us. I don't know if you knew him or not. He died here about 7-8 years ago. His mother, who was my first cousin, died last year. Solus was a brilliant, brilliant guy. Harvard Law, what have you, Phi Beta Kappa, the whole shebang. No personality, wouldn't attract anything, but brilliant. I could sit here for hours and tell you some of the stuff he did. Later on, he was in Washington. He was Lyndon Johnson's right arm in the Senate, mm-hmm. sat next to Jack Kennedy. And when a case came with the Kennedy or Johnson to be the candidate for the presidency, he quit. And when Kennedy became the president and Johnson vice president, which was a deal, he went back to the administration. He was in the Pentagon, and McNamara was Secretary of Defense. And if you looked at the next row, I'm a little one step ahead of myself. One night, about 11 o'clock, Solus got a call. Johnson, yes, Mr. President, I want to see you tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. The White House. Solus goes to the White House. He takes him out in the Rose Gardens, where he's been Assistant Secretary of Defense.
Just like that.
Just like that, because he'd been with him for a number of years, and he knew how brilliant he was. I can show you the letter he sent to his mother when Solus dropped dead from Lyndon Johnson.
She was your cousin.
He's my first cousin. Mm-hmm. Her mother and my mother were sisters. And Solus became Assistant Secretary, and on the same level, you know, Executive Vice President, all that stuff, there was McNamara was Secretary of Defense, then it was the three men, Cyrus Vance, who later became Secretary of State in the last administration, Solus Horvitz, and the third guy, I forget his name. And Solus was never married, used to spend his weekends down in Virginia at Cyrus Vance's home, very close. And I said to Ellie, when Cyrus Vance became Secretary of State in the last administration, the Carter administration, I said, if Solus Horvitz were living today, wouldn't that be something? He came to Pitt. When Pasvar was a May Chancellor, and Kurtzman, you remember Kurtzman was the acting chancellor, and they gave him the title full professor, which is an unusual rank, professor. And they were crazy about him there. Pasvar had served under me in the Pentagon, and he knew how brilliant this guy was. And this is the guy we had in the office. He couldn't attract a nickel's worth of business, but give him a problem, anything at all, and you couldn't push him. Mr. Alvin grind his teeth and go in there, and he finally sold some of his feet up on the desk reading a dime novel. And he'd lash out, and Horvitz pick
up. So you had good role models here.
Oh, yes.
But eventually, you must have had a case in your early career that stands out.
Well, the leading case that I had, the one that stands out in my mind, was the Pittsburgh, Shawmut, and Northern Railroad. The case that started in Buffalo, New York, and came to Pittsburgh. It was on the books for 40 years here.
Is that right?
And nothing had been done about it. Meantime, this railroad ran from St. Mary's, originally from Katanning, but then it still had the railroad up there, Pittsburgh and Shawmut. But Pittsburgh, Shawmut, and Northern, they operated coal mines up around St. Mary's, Pennsylvania, in that area, and went up into New York State. And there had been a mortgage foreclosure on the railroad and never went through, and they had a receiver appointed in the thing to handle it. I was, some lawyer down the eastern part of the state got me into it. And as soon as when the war was over, Second World War, the case had been laying there 4 or 5 years, and I couldn't get anywhere with it because there was nobody to talk to. The judges were too busy. And I got into that situation, and finally I had the receiver removed and my receiver put in. And I represented the two receivers. Two were put in. And the federal judge from Philadelphia was assigned the case because the Pittsburgh judges were so old, one they were just dying off. There just were three in those days. Mm-hmm. And it took us a year and a half to liquidate that railroad. And
well, now, who was your client?
I represented the receivers.
Who would be?
These were here, one from Pittsburgh, one from Beaver. Mm-hmm. And one of them had been in the government's cabinet in Harrisburg, and he was friendly with the federal judge, and he was appointed. And I had Mr. Sproul, who was a CPA, appointed, and I represented the two receivers. And we looked at it about a year and a half. I traveled Danville, New York, Harrisburg, Buffalo, Washington, D.C., any number of times before the ICC Commission to get all that. We had so many things to do that when the federal judge ruled on the what services we rendered, he talked about, well, I don't want it to be too lacking in humility, about the brilliant so-and-so. What we did there was really miraculous. I mean, mm-hmm. a year and a half, we took the thing that had been on the books for 40-odd years. It was the oldest case on the books.
What year was that?
In 1948 or 50, mm-hmm. in that area. And I traveled, like, oh, I worked myself to a frazzle. It was a year and a half. And, by the way, L.B. Foster Company ended up being one of the purchasers.
Oh.
Byron Foster.
Now, do you enter into that?
Oh, yes, definitely. That was
I mean, do
that.
They come to you, or do you go out and seek purchasers?
Well, we advertise for bidders and all
I
that
see.
Sort of thing.
Okay.
And L.B. Foster Company made a deal. Somebody was interested in the coal operator. They had mm-hmm. this railroad, owned coal mines up there. There was a woman doctor, a very pretty gal, who filed complaints, had complained that hit the headlines about the condition of the houses around the coal mine, the mines. And that started the whole thing, and that's how we got into the picture originally. And it ended that way, finally liquidity.
15 minutes.
And I traveled back and forth up the same river. It was like 150 miles in the wintertime. And we finally went up there to settle the strikes. The miners had walked out. And the judge went along with us because he had a sister living in Clearfield. And he's going to take the Pennsylvania Railroad from Clearfield into Philadelphia because he was from down the Philadelphia area.
Mm-hmm.
His name was Guy Bard, B-A-R-D, a little Pennsylvania Dutchman, brilliant guy. And he had been attorney general, succeeded him, Charlie Margiotti.
Mm-hmm.
And Margiotti was in the case with me because I had no money for investigation and all the things that we do. And on the way up to... Margiotti sat behind me when I tried the case before the judge bought Guy Bard and had the former receiver removed and the new one put in. On the way up in the car, driving up to St. Mary's, he said, "What connection does Mr. Margiotti have with this case?" I told him exactly what happened. He said, "Tell me when you get back, get the hell out of the case with my compliments." the Democrats had been fighting at that time and all that sort of thing. So when I got back to Pittsburgh, I called him. I said, "General," he had been attorney general, and Bard succeeded him, by the way. I told him what happened. He laughed at me. He said, "Okay, Barney, it's all right with me." He was out of the case, Margiotti. And we used to laugh about and kid about the thing, but I really got into it big and heavy. That's where I made my
name. That was really where you made your name.
I made my name there, and then in the Pittsburgh Railways case, I worked with Ann Alperin very closely.
What year?
Well, it started in 1938,
mm-hmm.
and it ended about 1950-odd. All during that period, I was with Mr. Alperin, and I did an awful lot of work.
Did this eventually then become PAT? Pittsburgh.
Yes. Pittsburgh Railways, PAT. Uh-huh. That's right. And it was through our efforts that the money was accumulated to put the settlement through and work out the whole reorganization of the railways company. Ann Alperin did a good job. She argued the case in the United States Supreme Court, and we won the case.
Now, what was the case? How would you...
Pittsburgh Railway. It grew out of the fact that we said that we represented what they called the Tort Creditors Committee.
Mm-hmm.
The tort creditors were the lawyers who had claims against the railroad for personal injury cases.
Uh-huh.
And all of which were tied up by the bankruptcy of the railroad, of the railway. So we were retained as counsel for the Tort Creditors Committee. And we opposed the payment of the taxes of the underlying company, all these little companies, the politicians over the years. If you got the franchise for a streetcar on Carson Street, South Side, you got a block of stock or something or other. And we argued in the Supreme Court, and we won, that that money should not be paid to these underliers. And that money was used to make the settlement with the credit to work out to all the claims. And I had left Mr. Alperin at that point. I had remarried, and I went into practice with Ellie Cooper. We weren't partner. We just had Cooper and Goodman.
Uh-huh.
Ellie Cooper just left the bench.
Yes.
And he'd only served a short time and was defeated for the full term. And
you never saw yourself in a big law firm?
No, never. No.
You weren't interested?
In recent years, in the last 10 years, both Alan Berkman and Bob Engel came to see me on several occasions about going with their firm, joining Restlander and the whole setup. And also Phil Baskin came to see me a number of times going with his firm. And I decided I wanted my independence. At my age, I wasn't going to get involved with big firms. Mm-hmm. I didn't need the money. I didn't want the headache.
But when you were younger, did you consider it?
Well, if I told you there wasn't any Jewish law firms in Pittsburgh.
Is that right?
There was Saxon Kaplan, just the two of them, and they hated each other's guts.
Well, Restlander was...
Restlander was nothing. He was down there with Main & Company, the accountants. Uh-huh. And he wasn't doing... And Alan Berkman was with Dave Glick, who was my cousin, by the way, and who died some years ago, a brilliant guy. There was no Pittsburgh Jewish law firm. Everyone was a rugged individualist.
You practiced alone.
I practiced alone, that's right.
But there were non-Jewish law firms who probably...
Well, but they didn't take Jews.
They didn't.
It wasn't until recent years there was anything. And then one by one, Reed Smith took one. Uh-huh. Why did they... Reed Smith take one, Reed Smith, Sean McClay. The father of Leonard Scheinholz, you know him?
I know the name.
Yeah. His father was in the tax department in Harrisburg, mm-hmm. and Reed Smith Shaw McClay wanted an in.
Yeah.
And they took Leonard Scheinholz into their office.
Hmm.
That's one of the first Jewish people. Berger, Buchanan Ingersoll firm, David Berger, his father-in-law was Alder, owned the Jewish Criterion.
Uh-huh. So why would they want that?
Berger was in that firm. Why? Because his father was the inventor of the cracking process in gasoline, and was with the Gulf Oil Company.
Mm. And so they wanted an end to Gulf.
And they were the attorneys for the Gulf.
Uh-huh.
That's how he got into that firm.
Uh-huh. So there was really that kind of prejudice.
Oh, yeah.
Thorpe
Reed and Armstrong had no Jews in there until Louis Kaplan went over there some few years ago.
Uh-huh.
After, you know, Leonard Morse... who was with him, we didn't even take him along. Leonard Morse died of a broken heart. He went over there and they put him on a separate floor, a different floor from where their main offices. Louis Kaplan, you wouldn't believe it. It's a fact.
They didn't want anybody to know they had a Jewish lawyer?
That's right, so just about to want him out or two.
Was his name not on the door?
Not on there, it was of consultant or of the firm or something like that. I forget what it was.
Huh.
But it was on a separate floor, different
floor. Why did he accept that?
I don't know. I could tell you stories about him, but he's considered a god in some quarters, but it's not in my book. Not in my book. Someday I'll tell you the story off the record.
Yeah, we'll have to put the machine on.
I think you would like it.
Among the Jewish lawyers, was there a camaraderie? Were you referred to each other?
No, I wouldn't say no. They were all rugged individuals.
Dog-eat-dog.
Dog-eat-dog. I mean, there was Joe Staffeld, who had married a non-Jew, and he never associated with Jews. And Mr. Alperin had started out as a stenographer in his office while he was going to law school himself.
Mm.
And he wouldn't even keep him, brilliant as he was, he wouldn't keep Mr. Alperin after Mr. Alperin graduated law school.
That
was the kind of thing. And right down the line, there was any number of them, and each of them had his individual practice, and most of them struggled, and most of them never amounted to royal pins, and some of them got involved in trouble and all that sort of thing. But there wasn't anything like that.
But still, it was prestigious. To become a lawyer.
Yeah, there was,
for example,
were you originally from McKeesport?
Yes.
I mean, there was Frank R.S. Kaplan
right.
McKeesport. There was A.M. Simon, who
right.
was a brilliant lawyer.
Uh-huh.
Frank Kaplan was not a brilliant lawyer.
Uh-huh.
Absolutely not. He was a phony in my book.
Uh-huh.
He was a great promiser and never did anything. I can tell you stories there galore, too. But that was the history. But there weren't any... Frank was an individual lawyer. I mean, Kaplan had Izzy Goldsmith with him for quite some time.
You know, there weren't that many, I don't think, of your generation, that many who were even college educated.
That's right.
So to go beyond
They could go from high school right into law school.
Uh-huh. Is that what you did?
No. They took the preliminary bar exams.
Uh-huh.
And they passed them, they could enter into law school. Law school was 3 years. Someone went to night school, worked during the day, went to Duquesne Law School at night. When I went to Pitt in 1916, we had what they call a six-year course, 3 years in college, which I did, and then you went into law school. At the end of your first year in law school, you got your college degree. That was considered your major.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the 3 years in law school, you got your law degree. I have the two degrees.
So you went 6 years. And
I went to 6 years.
Today they give 7 years or 8 years?
No, now it's 8 years. No, 7 years. Four years in college and 3 years they have
to
have your
degree.
A year is different.
Yeah.
But what happened in my particular case is that in 1918, or 19 spring, so 1970, at the end of my freshman year at Pitt, we got into the First World War.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't even bother to take the examinations. And I wanted to get into service. All the boys wanted to get into something. And ended up in 1918, I was in Atlanta, Georgia, at officers' training camp in the infantry.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a First World War veteran at 18.
And you had 1 year at Pitt then?
I had 1 year at Pitt at that point.
Then
I came back and went into Pitt.
And were you overseas?
No. I was only in a ship.